morning. We're just about to start today's class. We'll begin in about 1 minute. Doug, how are you?
I'm doing okay. How about yourself?
Okay, feeling better. Much better, thanks.
Oh, that's good. Francesca and Tasha are with us also.
Hey, Francesca, how are you?
Doing good.
Good. Hey, Josh.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, if I can, before we start, Josh and Francesca, if you could take a couple of minutes at your earliest convenience, if you feel so inclined to do so, and email me just a couple, two or three quotable comments about your experience at the conference or what you thought of it or anything about that. Linda Mann asked me if I would put together an article about the conference itself, which they could distribute in their local press there and so forth, and I thought I would try to write it a little bit as a news article and quote some of the attendees. So if you are comfortable being quoted about it, if you could just drop me some stuff in the email, that'd be great. And if you're not comfortable with that, that's okay too.
I'd be happy to do that, Doug. Thanks. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Who is this?
It's the
Rabbi?
Yes, hi. How are you?
Yeah, good morning, Rabbi Trifka. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, anybody else on?
Yeah, everybody's here already.
Okay.
Doug and Cal and Francesca and Josh and Laura just joined us online.
Cal and Doug and Josh, I loved the articles in the Jewish Times. Thank you so much for sharing all that information.
You're
and,
welcome.
Yeah, I love them. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to resume with Koheles. And we are up to verses, chapter 3, verse 14 and 15. Okay, so up to this point, just to review, so we're discussing King Solomon's analysis of man's search for happiness and security and looking for absolute answers. I mean, looking for things that will always provide him with happiness. That's why he started chapter 3 by saying that everything has a time and a place, meaning he's addressing man's desire that things should not have a time and a place, meaning I want something to always have to afford me a security and a happiness. So when King Solomon teaches, as is the case with everything else in the Torah, it's addressing man's opposing view. So we're told not to steal, it's because we have an inclination to take things from others because we want them. We're told not to speak derogatory about other people because we have an inclination to do so. And also the same thing happens, same thing applies when we're told by King Solomon that everything has a time and a place because we have a disposition that we don't want things to have a time and a place. We want things to always afford happiness. And the underlying motivation behind that is that we want to have security. We want to have things that we can always rely on. It's going to give us exactly the satisfaction that we're looking for. King Solomon says, no, that is not how the world operates. That's not how the human being works. And God has done this, as he says in verse 9, to afflict man, but not afflict man in a negative sense. It means to train him away from emotional inclinations and to get him on a path of where he looks at things from a standpoint of wisdom, where he understands how reality works. a person that chases after his wishes is what the rabbis call a wicked person. Like Rabbi Jay explained, the wicked person projects his wishes onto reality, and he tries to make reality conform to his internal world, whereas the wise man is the opposite. He looks to conform himself to what he sees is real in an external world. So an external world is what's real to him, and that is the truth. The world does operate a certain way, and the wise person is the one who cultivates his intelligence and controls his emotions and brings himself and his desires and his values and his virtues under the guide of reality, of what he perceives as true, and he doesn't distort it in his mind. He accepts it. His agenda is something which is cast aside because he understands that trying to push forth his own agenda won't succeed. You can't change how the world operates. So the person who's not going to be in conflict will be the one who looks at the world, examines it intellectually, objectively, and conforms himself to it. And this is just one of the many lessons where you have to not look at things as being absolutely satisfying, because sometimes, you know, having a party is not the right thing. Sometimes you have to mourn. Sometimes you have to have war. Sometimes you have to have peace. Nothing is going to be appropriate all the time. And he goes through, as we did the past couple of weeks, you know, various explanations and where man is looking for that happiness, with how the ego is part of that, and how even man looks into the future. For example, let's see where we had that verse. Yeah, that was 12, where he says that I know that the only good for man is to be happy and to do good in his life. So that we talked about, where if a person is trying to do something here in order to get an imaginary good in the next world, but he doesn't know what the next world is. So he's just going through the motions here. Therefore, anything he does here is really not what he really wants, because he's really holding out for what he imagines is to have in the next world. So in such a case, the person is not living for the day. He's not living in the moment. He's not really valuing the study, even if he's involved in Torah study. If he thinks he's doing it, he's just going through the motions because he's going to get something else after he dies, so then he doesn't really value the Torah study. So the only way to really value it is that he's doing the good in his life, meaning now. So the current activity is something which he does not look at any ulterior motive. Then he could really enjoy his study, because he's doing it for the study itself. And this is what we're going to touch on a little bit now. He says now, the following. He says in 14, we're up to him. Okay, so now we're going to break some new ground. I know that everything which God has done, it will be forever. Upon it you cannot add, and from it you cannot subtract. And God has performed this in order that we should fear before Him. What already occurred, it was already. And what will yet be in the future, it too already was. And God desires that which is sought out. God desires that which is chased, which is sought out. This sounds like two verses that just come in the middle of nowhere. Again, I'll read it one more time. So King Solomon says, I know that all that which God has done, or that God does, it always will be, forever. Upon it you cannot add, and from it man cannot subtract. And God has done this in order that man should fear before Him. So the first thing he's saying is that there can be no change at all. Anything which God has done, is permanent. It's fixed. Man maybe can take some sand and make bricks and make buildings and melt down sand into glass and make windows. That is just manipulating that which exists, and that which is permanent. So what is he saying with that? And what does it mean that God has done this so man should fear before Him? That's the first question. And the second verse, that which was Mashahoya Kavar, that which already was in the past. Mashahoya, that which transpired, Kavarhu, it already was. And that which will be, so he says also, Kavarhoya, that also was already. All right? What's the new topic in this verse? And how does he conclude this verse? And he says, God desires that which is to be sought out. God desires that which is chaste. Right? C-H-A-S-E-D. God desired that which is being chased. Okay, say up to this point, these are the most enigmatic verses we've had so far, but let's see if we can unravel it a bit. And keep in mind the context. Okay, the verse is clear just in terms of the facts.
Well, I'd say the words are clear. I'm not sure I understand what they mean in terms of the facts.
Well, the literal meaning. I mean, the literal reading is... questions on that?
Well... I mean, I guess I have several. It says, I knew that everything that God made, that will be forever. Except the earth itself and our physical lives and so forth are temporal. So what does it mean that it's forever?
I think Maimonides says that there's no reason why the earth in the universe cannot exist forever. People come and go. He actually says it in the beginning of the book. He says, a generation comes and a generation goes, but the world will always be. He says that...
But my translation, which may be incorrect, says, I knew that everything that God made, that will be forever.
Right, but we do know he's not denying death. He's not denying human death. In chapter 1, verse 4, generation comes, a generation goes, and a generation comes, and the earth will always stand. Okay, so that's 1:4 in Kabbalah. Now, of course, he can't be saying over here that when he says everything will be forever, it doesn't mean individual people.
Okay. And then is it then it says we cannot add nor can we subtract from it. So does that suggest that, you know, the puny little amount that a man does during his life does not affect that which stays forever?
Right. Again, we can manipulate what exists.
And God made it so that they fear him. That seems like an odd place to stick that in.
Yes. I think that's King Solomon's method. That's how he evokes our questions and points us to answers. The contrast is always something which catches the intellect.
So that's, I guess, one question. Then the next one is in 15 when it says that which is already done, that which was is already done. Okay, that seems obvious. That which is destined to be already was, that does not seem so obvious.
Okay.
Maybe from God's framework, but from our framework of time, that seems contradictory. And then, of course, the last part, you know, God seeks to pursue, seems to be a complete enigma.
Yes.
I don't know if this is important or not, but I noticed that there's a... Yeah, I may be reaching here. In 14, there are like two things and an enigma. We can't add to it, we can't subtract from it. God made it so they fear him. In 15, there are two things. That which is, that which is to be, it was, and then an enigma statement.
Right, it's true. They are following a pattern.
Yeah. I don't know if that...
Let's see, we'll have to see if that will actually bear some fruits. Something is because we might think otherwise. What is the otherwise that we would think that these two verses are coming to correct? Let's try to, you know, apply our rule that we've been using throughout. Again, he's speaking, he's addressing human nature, some aspect of human nature here. What is it that he's addressing? Or better said is, what is he correcting? What's the wrong idea that he's trying to correct?
Well, in 14, could it be he's trying to correct the wrong idea that I might have, that I could somehow affect the world, or that what I do makes a long-term difference?
Very good. Now, what's the next step? That's exactly right.
Well, if I were going down that road, then I'd ask, well, if nothing I do makes a long-term difference, what's the point of doing all this stuff?
You mean if I'm really trying to make a difference, if I'm really trying to add and or subtract from the world, and King Solomon's saying, no, you can't add, you can't subtract. But if he's telling me that I can't do it, that must mean that I want to do it. That is natural human disposition, to add or to subtract to the world. Then the next question would be what? Again, we're trying to understand human nature.
Well, if I were doggedly determined to affect the world, I might ask, well, if I can't, then how can I?
Well, you could also ask, well, why do I want to affect the world? You could ask what the motivation is.
Okay, and I would presume the answer to that would be some fantasy about immortality. Somehow if I do this thing, I'll be remembered for generations.
Good. All right. So you basically, you got the answer. Very good. It's that the person is looking for the satisfaction. Again, this whole chapter here, he's talking about how man is seeking out satisfaction in all different avenues. And here, it's by something new. He's adding, he's subtracting, he's making a change, he is now making a positive effect. I am doing something. So of course the answer is that you can't do it. But he's addressing man's desire to add to the world. So man, now let's just go step by step. So now that man is trying to add, and King Solomon has to tell you, don't look over there for happiness, but nonetheless, let's understand man's predisposition. So this way we can understand how King Solomon is giving us an insight to correct us. You can only understand his answer if we know the question, right?
Right.
So he's telling us that don't look to add or subtract from the world because it's fixed. Right? As he says, Leolam, you can't get onto it. It will be this way forever. Oh, man must be trying to make some change. He has some sort of a misconception that he can make a change. He can do something new over here. Now he asks, so why does man want to make some sort of a new thing or make a mark? So I think this opens up an area that we haven't touched on yet, and it's a very primary emotion, which I feel permeates so many parts of our lives. And it's one word for it. Novelty. That man assumes, and I think the best example is the new toy emotion. You give a little child, a 3-year-old, you give him a new toy. It could be very similar to something he has already. You wrap it up in a box with wrapping paper and a ribbon on the top, and you hand it to him, and his eyes are just like popping out of his head, exciting, and he's almost, not almost, but he is, he's like shaking in excitement, open it up, what's inside, and he gets it, and he's absorbed in it for 5 minutes. But Those 5 minutes are the most intense euphoria that kid has had all week. And the novelty will wear off. But there is novelty. There is, that is a real phenomenon. And it has different expressions as we get older. But I believe that's what he's talking about over here. What King Solomon is underlining is that man is searching for some, if I can have some area where there's something new. So that is now going to translate into happiness. And that's a real innate thing which was learned from childhood. And I want you to know, it is true. It does work. There's only one problem. Besides the fact that it wears off, is that people look for it in the wrong area. But I just want you to see the path that we took, is that the first step is we understand clearly what he's saying in this verse. Just what's the plain facts? He's telling you that you can't add, you can't subtract, everything which God made is fixed forever. So then we have to ask ourselves a question, well, why is he telling us this? Evidently, we don't want to hear it. It's something which we think otherwise. Why? The next question is, why would we think otherwise? Oh, because we want to have the ability to make something new. Why do we want to have something new? Because that we have a, which it's part of nature and nurture, that something new, something novel, is going to be refreshing to our soul, something going to be enjoyable. Okay, so that's the path we took. Everybody see so far? Any questions?
That makes sense.
A rabbi?
Yes.
So the adding of something is the novelty that we're looking for in an incorrect place?
Yes, because it's going to wear off. That's also part of novelty. And
okay.
it is a real thing. The question is where should a person look for it? Is it to be searched after? And I mean, God made it. So again, there always has to be a reason for any emotion that we have or any faculty of the mind. If God designed it, it means it's essential to our being. Now we have to see where to look for it. But he's telling you over here is that if you're looking for it in terms of making a mark on the world, like Doug was pointing out, so there you're trying to have novelty and ego come together. You see, that's the wrong way to do it. You're looking for the novelty is a good thing. Novelty is refreshing to the soul. But a person can mix his emotions up and be confused as to where to seek out something. He's misguided. See, what is a person doing in that case? He's trying to project his own signature on the world. And that's where he imagines. That's the greatness that Doug was talking about. Okay? But that is not the right pursuit. Why? Look at the last words of this verse. It fits in beautifully. God has done this that we fear before him. God knows that a person is going to go after this. He understands the human nature. He designed it. But he says, no, don't look to put your signature on the world. You should be looking at the world as a means of fearing before him. You see? You see how the last words tell you the point? You want to add, you want to subtract for your own ego. No. God has done this in order that you should fear before him. Meaning, the creation, the world as it is, it should be a means of perceiving and witnessing new insights. Not for projecting your mark on it. Okay, is the verse clear as a whole?
So is he saying that, okay, yes, this novelty is refreshing, but it's not going to work if you try to do it in the physical world, but that the novelty and the newness that you're seeking is in the discovery in the world of ideas?
Right, and that I'm going to show you from the next verse.
Okay.
With the help of Sforno. I couldn't do it without Sforno's help here. He says in the next verse, that which was already transpired already was. I mean, anything which happened already, it's something which is, it's been before also. even the future and that which is going to be. I mean, he's saying that there's nothing, no new things. But didn't he just say that in the last verse? He said you can't add, you can't subtract, right? So what is he now talking about? Sounds like he's repeating himself. Anything which is going to happen now in the future? No, it already happened. Let's just understand what the facts are over there. And how is this something new compared to the previous verse? What's this new point here?
Rabbi?
Yes?
Does this have to do with time in the sense that God knows everything that was and everything that will be, in the sense that time is only a phenomenon of man, and that God is eternal?
Okay, what would be the purpose of telling us that then?
That God is all-knowing and in control of everything, and that man is nothing?
Well, I mean, Ibn Ezra does talk about that. I really cannot honestly say I understand the Ibn Ezra. He does seem to be talking about time, that it's like a dot on a ball. If I understand his metaphor, like a dot on a ball, so at the same time, what's in front of the dot is in front of it, but it's also behind it, because if you wrap around, it comes up behind the dot. So it's like whatever is going forward is now coming around the back of the ball. And he's using that as a parable, as a metaphor for time, which I don't really understand. I can't say it's wrong. And I'm sure you know every verse has numerous ideas. But my intent was to try to understand how this verse follows and how it's part of the whole context. And what struck me is that the first verse is talking about creation, objects. Tangible physical objects. You can't add and you can't subtract. Okay, that's talking about physical objects, right? What's verse 15 talking about? It's not talking about objects, but it's talking about what?
Ideas? Or time?
It's talking about time, but we have to just bring the what
actions?
Actions, good. Events. Good. Actions and events, right. Meaning the world exists of two things. There are the objects, and then there's the activities of the world. If you actually look at Genesis, you'll see that the creation is talked about in those two areas. It talks about what God created, and I think in chapter 2, verse 4, it starts talking about events and the behavior, and how the plants didn't grow yet, there was no rain, and then it goes into the whole understanding of man and the name of the animals, and he was alone, meaning the behavior of things, the actions. So if we look at the physical world, there's objects and then there's events. So I believe that's what King Solomon is categorizing over here. He's saying, number one, in verse 14, don't look for your novelty in terms of objects. Because that type of a lifestyle where you're going after putting your mark on the physical world as an ego expression is not where you're going to get the satisfaction. The physical world is really made just the opposite, that you should fear God. That's how it concludes verse 14. 15 is talking about events. That which already occurred, it happened many times before. And that which is going to happen in the future, that too. Meaning, don't get excited about, oh, there's something new here. No, he's telling you it happened already. Why is he telling you it happened already? Because, again, the person could look for that novelty emotion. Not just in objects, but in actions. Oh, what's going to happen in the future? No, everything, don't think there's anything so substantially different than what happened in the past already. Again, it's another area. A man makes a mistake and he looks to have happiness. I'm going to do this event, that event. No, so many people have done that before. How did that affect their lives? How did that... Yes, there's certain things you have to do. People have to work. You constantly have to plant. You always need to have produce. You need to have clothing. This will never change, right? Maybe styles change. Maybe the people used to live in tents, and now they live in 100th floor skyscrapers. It's still the same category. nothing really new qualitatively. And if you're looking in these areas in terms of objects like buildings and styles, or if you're looking in terms of events, oh, a new thing, a new, we're going to do a new activity, we're going to travel the world, this and that, whatever it is, this has been done already. So he's trying to show you that in these two areas, which encompasses all of our experiences, all right, objects and events, in these two areas, it's a mistake if you're going to invest your energy to look for that novelty, to look for that which refreshes you. So far, so good?
I guess.
Is it clear? It's clear? We're talking about objects in verse 14 and events in verse 15, and he's applying both. And you see, maybe that's why there was the pattern that Doug, you pointed out, because he's saying, in terms of objects, you can't change. And change is subject to add, addition, and subtraction. That's what he talks about in terms of objects. In terms of events, time, so time spans two realms. It's either the future or the past, right? You can't really stand on the present because it's gone already. So there's the future and the past. And he says in both those areas there, because you see, why does he talk about the past? Why would a person even care about the past? It's gone. But you do see people talk about, oh, the good old times. A person's mind, when he's unhappy in, you know, in the current, as his progression into the future, if he's not happy there and he sees no light at the end of the tunnel there, so he thinks back. And he tries to get some satisfaction even in the past. But there's only two realms. So that's why he addresses, you know, the two. Now, here comes the enigma. What is the last part of the verse? He says, but God seeks out that which is chaste. So, it's just, that's a difficult statement. But, let's take a look at Sforno. So he says as follows, and this is on this verse, 3:15. So he says that the intelligence of man seeks out to reach its completion with in-depth thought and action, and that is that which is chaste. From all other of the other strengths of man that are more physical. As the rabbis state, and they quote, they said, God put the Sefer Torah, God put the Torah in his bosom. And he said, like he was holding it next to his chest, and he said, anybody who engages in it should come and take its reward. So you might yell at me for explaining one enigma with another enigma. But what does it mean? He's saying over here the statement of the rabbis that God placed the Torah in his bosom. And he said, Mish Asik Bazan, anybody who engages in this, who immerses himself in this, let him come and take his reward. Meaning only the one who immerses himself in the Torah is going to get the reward. Just reading it is not going to work. There has to be an immersion of the whole self searching out. Oh, searching. Chasing it. This is what is where the act of chasing should be. This is what it means at the end of the verse. That God desires that which is chaste, meaning God wants man to be involved in that which requires a chasing. This is where you're going to get your novelty, and this is where you're going to get your satisfaction. In the area that you have to, as Sforno says, that the intelligent soul is seeking out its completion, meaning the person is not born happy. You have to, and the soul is the most essential part of the human being, the core. And we know that. You see, the worst insult to a person is not if he dresses poorly or if he picked the wrong dish and wine combination. The worst insult is to call a person stupid, because a person knows, he senses this. Rabbi Chaim once talked about this, and he said, a person senses that that's really the highest element. That's really what is the he can be the most proud of, and that's what he can be the most embarrassed of. Is the opposite is that if a person is caught being instinctual, doing something very instinctual. People are very, very careful when they eat and they go on business dinners and they dress very nicely and they have such etiquette. Why is etiquette such a reality? It's a denial, as Rabbi Chaim explained it, the denial of the instincts. Person senses that that is a very low thing and that makes him, it equates him to the animal world. The man doesn't want that. When Adam was punished by God after rebelling, and God says, now you're going to eat the grass of the field. So the Talmud says that Adam said to God, I and my donkey are going to eat from the same trough, from the same basket. I mean, he couldn't take the blow to the ego, that now he's going to be exactly as the animal in terms of food. So then God responded, it's all right, by the sweat of your brow you will eat bread. He gave man a little bit of a difference. He allowed his ego to be evolved, meaning I'll give you something which requires toil, which requires ingenuity. To make bread is not just something, you don't just pick it off the tree, you don't just bite the grass off the ground, but you'll have to, there's some creativity to it, there's dignity to that. But you see, there's a problem with man, initially, that he didn't want to be equated to the beast. So that's the opposite, that's the real, the lowest part of man, but the highest part of man, and what he really values the most is his intelligence. So that has to be where the greatest satisfaction will be. So that's why it says in this verse that King Solomon is telling him in 14, don't look after the physical world to make your mark in terms of ego and novelty. That's not where to get you. You'll have some novelty, yes. It'll wear off, though, and it's also not going to be something so valued by you. And you may also look not in the world of the physical in terms of objects and creation, but you may also look in terms of events, activities. These are things that you feel are going to give you some sort of a satisfaction, and you'll do something new, but don't even look there, because the novelty you're looking for, see, is not going to be something which will really impact you and give you the satisfaction. What is it that God designed you for? God desires that you go after that which is chaste. What is chaste? Again, the intelligence. That is what a person has to chase after and has to immerse himself into, unveil it, because that's the one thing in the world that requires man's ability to immerse himself and to go after it. You don't have to go after making a meal. You don't have to go after sexual drives. You don't have to go after making a building. They're very simple technical activities. There's no real chasing involved. You may have to work to earn the money to do it, so on. But that's just technical. The real area where man has to chase and engage and immerse himself and to be energetic and to have such a drive is what is a little elusive. And that's the world of wisdom, which you have to train the mind to uncover. And that is where the novelty is going to be. Because man does need novelty. And where's the novelty? When he sees a new idea. That's refreshing. And it also hits the soul as being very profound and fulfilling. The person is not going to brag about how many times he had intercourse or how many great steaks that he ate. That to him is very boorish. It's so base. A person doesn't want to do that. He understands that that's a little bit despicable. Maimonides says it's the most despicable, the sensual drives. It's necessary. But that is not life. That is not man's pursuit. The pursuit, that which really fulfills us the way we're designed, is the intelligence. But that takes chasing after. And that also is where, when we finally see something, wow, that novelty is, that's where novelty was meant. And we look and see a new idea all the time around the corner. And it's enjoyable. That's where man should team up the novel emotion with intelligence, with that pursuit, that which is he has to chase after. Okay, let me stop here and see if there's any questions or comments.
Makes sense.
Rabbi, it's just in that last verse, it says, God always seeks the pursued. That's my translation. I would think it would be the pursuer of truth and knowledge and all of that. But to say the pursued makes me think that something is chasing man.
The nirdaf means, the form of the word means that thing which is pursued.
So the pursued is knowledge and truth.
Right, the object that is pursued. That's what God desires.
Okay.
And am I correct then, we're taking the Sephorno's approach, but the small amount I have of Rashi suggests that he takes a completely different approach on that last clause?
Yeah, I think it's talking about punishment, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just don't. I think Sforno just really fits in well in terms of the theme of this entire chapter and the juxtaposition of these two verses.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
It's just amazing how King Solomon was able to write these few words and. I mean, again, it was divinely inspired. That's why. It's God's wisdom here that we're studying.
Does that mean that he had prophecy when he wrote this, or just that he was very, very wise, and so he wrote it in a very wise way?
It had to be some form of divine inspiration. I don't know if it's prophecy, but if that's accurate. I think even Maimonides talks about that when he wrote this, I'm not sure if it was the Mishnah Torah or the Guide for Perplexed, but he talks about one of those, that how it was with God's help. And those two works clearly, embody such great depths. Just amazing. But this is, this lesson here to me is really just fascinating. Now, just categorically, he was talking about just a few strokes of the pen over here. He's showing you how there's two realms in which man is seeking out that satisfaction, and the underlying thing which propels man into it is that novelty. So you see, God gave us the impetus, he gave us the libido, he gave us the drives, and he gave us a sense of satisfaction from youth that, yeah, something new is exciting, but where do we find it as adults? Where is it supposed to be expressed as adults? And that novelty is really going to be in that area. And this is one painting, Norman Rockwell. So many of his paintings, they're telling a story, but there was one where it's like two parts. There's the family in this black sedan in the middle, the 50s, the 60s, and you get the father and the mother and the grandmother and the dog and the kids in the back, and everybody is excited as they see that the car is facing left as they're heading out for the family vacation. Even the dog has got his tongue out and his head is out the window, almost just about, you can almost see the dog is smiling too, and everybody's excited except for the grandmother. She's just sitting back in the seat, stern faced, holding her purse. And then you have the next part of the picture, which is they're returning from the vacation. And the father's exhausted, the mother is tired, the kids are hot, sweaty, whatever. Even the dog is drooping. Grandmother's the same expression. What's his point? Been there, done that. Everybody who was still young, they were fantasizing, yeah, this is going to be it. Something great is going to happen, da-da-da-da. But, the grandmother's been around the block a number of times and knows, this is, I understand what's going to happen. There's nothing to get excited about. She's going. Change is nice. Doesn't say she's upset, but she wasn't elated about it. She was realistic. And there was no disappointment because there was no expectation. That's why she had the same expression coming back. So you see that he's embodying that thing we're talking about in the second verse, that looking at events, let's get excited about this. No, you're looking at the wrong area. Your excitement. You're looking in the wrong area for that novelty. Yes, novelty is important, but where is that novelty going to really register on you and give you true, enduring satisfaction? It's going to be in the area of knowledge and pursuing ideas. And Cal and Doug, this is what you're talking about in your presentation last week at the conference, where you mentioned the idea of always questioning. And the one thing I liked, I got a kick out of that when you said, Doug, the example, if I were to give you $1 million to jump out of an airplane, would you do it? And the question was asked to many, many people. Not one person said that they would take $1 million to jump out of an airplane. And then Doug said at the end, but the person should have asked one thing first. Is the airplane in the air or still on the runway? So there was a very good example of not accepting anything on face value and questioning. Don't be swayed by any assumptions. So questioning, and that's exactly what he's saying over here. The process of questioning, pursuing questions, that is what really registers. That's what really gives us that satisfaction, because that's how we're designed. Trying, you know, don't try to fight City Hall. Don't try to fight the way God designed the human being. And that there are going to be a lot of assumptions that we have in life, but we have to question them, test them. But here we've got a great gift of one of the wisest men ever that was given miraculous knowledge overnight when he was 12 years old and assumed the kingdom after King David died. His father died. God came to him in a vision and said, ask what I should give to you. So King Solomon asked for wisdom. And God gave it to him. And we have that knowledge that this is divinely inspired, so we've got a shortcut to, instead of waiting to experience and make mistakes ourselves, we've got a whole, we have volumes over here of profound ideas that can save us from making those mistakes. And when we see them clearly, it becomes part of our thinking, and we steer clear of making those wrong, taking those wrong paths, and our lives will just become that much more advanced and enjoyable because we see it clear and we apply it. Okay. Okay, any questions or comments? I think that was what I wanted to discuss today.
Makes sense, Rabbi. Thank you.
Sure. All right. Everybody else good?
Yeah. Yep.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Rabbi.
Okay, my pleasure. All right, so I guess we'll pick up next week, continue on the next verse. We'll start 16. So,
All right. Have yourself a great week.
Okay, you too. You too, everybody.
All right.
Okay. Good seeing everybody last week. It was nice seeing you all again.
Have a good week, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.